Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar. Josh is still on the road trying to sell those books, Michael. You got to do what you can. Michael Phillips is here.
And find himself. I think he really went on the road to find himself.
Why else do you set out on the road?
Exactly.
Thank you so much for stopping by to help us close out the marathon. You helped us start the Vincent Minnelli Marathon.
Well, we opened the curtain,
yes.
A beautifully appointed curtain, I'm sure, in Minnelli's hands, and now we're closing it.
Yeah, we'll see how our choreography does here and whether or not we have any chemistry.
Good.
Together.
I like it.
We will get to our review of Some Came Running in just a moment. We first want to remind you that our partner for this Minnelli Marathon is Mubi. An algorithm has no business choosing your films. Mubi is a curated online cinema streaming exceptional films from around the globe. Every day, they pick a new gem, and you have 1 month to watch it. You can also delve deeper into the films with exclusive interviews, video essays, and critical reviews over at Mubi's Notebook. A couple new to Mubi films to highlight this week. Karame from 2010. It's their latest in a Chinese independent special, a series which spotlights groundbreaking documentaries that have recently come out of China, often produced against the will of the state despite unimaginable risks in order to tell their stories. This is a documentary that confronts the tragic fire that forever altered life in the village of Karame, banned in its home country to this day. The scope of the film's length is carried by its will to listen to the victims' families with their rare, enveloping patience. Mubi says it's essential. It certainly sounds like it. They also started its retrospective of films by German director Angela Schanelek, whom Mubi describes as one of the most important yet underseen contemporary directors. The retrospective starts with 2001's Passing Summer. You can check those films out now. Just go to Mubi.com/filmspotting. That's Mubi.com/filmspotting to start your free trial. And with that, let's get to Frank Sinatra and Martha Heyer in 1958's Some Came Running.
Where do you want me to drop you?
I don't.
I must. I really do have papers to correct.
I like the way you do your hair.
I have a feeling you're running away from something. Or after something. Of course, you'd have to know which it is before you could discover what it is.
You also got fascinating eyes.
I have a theory that writers create to compensate for some lack in their personal lives.
It's because we need to be stimulated. It smells good. What is it?
It's a bug repellent. Do you like it?
If I'm remembering that scene correctly, Michael, Frank Sinatra, uncomfortably close to Martha Heyer.
Very close in the front seat.
Very close. Not the only uncomfortable moment with Frank Sinatra and an actress in this film.
No, no. It's
full of them.
That's right. And the woman we just heard from, Gwen, is the small town Indiana local intellectual. She's the English teacher and teaches creative writing and criticism. And Dave, played by Sinatra, is the novelist wrestling with writer's block and self-loathing. He's come back home for the first time in 14 years. After knocking around.
Just got out of the military.
Yeah, and he's knocked around oil fields and all kinds of things. He's just trying to find himself, like Josh, on the road.
Right.
And this is this is one of the most 50s of all the 50s sounding dialogue exchanges in Some Came Running. It's not necessarily why I love the film, but it's definitely emblematic of the Madonna whore complex at the heart of it.
So, yeah, there really is a lot going on there just in terms of sensuality and sexual appetite. It's at the core of a lot of what's going on in this film. I really want to hear what you love about this movie in a moment, but to get the discussion rolling, we are going to hear, as we have for every film in this marathon, from Nathaniel in Indiana.
Hey, guys. One of the things I'm grateful for with these marathons is the way that they can upend my expectations and expose my misconceptions. This has certainly been the case with Minnelli, whom I knew only as a director of fairly light and optimistic musicals. But with Some Came Running, I once again found myself surprised by its cynicism and by its fairly unforgiving critique of small-town America. The film felt less like Meet Me in St. Louis and more like Meet Me in St. Louis by way of The Bad and the Beautiful. Which is not to say that, for me, this film is perhaps quite as good as either of those other two. Some plot turns felt at times a little overly convenient, for example, not least in the relationship between Sinatra's Dave and Martha Hyer's Gwen, which takes a lot of quick turns, many of which feel unearned, I think, because her character isn't all that clearly defined. And the film does present an uncomfortably outdated masculinity. I realize that this helps create complicated characters that suit this film's particular worldview, but if we're supposed to sympathize at all with Sinatra as he navigates these two worlds he doesn't quite fit in, his aggressive behavior towards Hyer, and even more so his absolute cruelty towards Shirley MacLaine's Ginny, makes that at times a challenging task. But of course, part of that is because among the very best elements of this film is clearly Shirley MacLaine, whose performance is just so moving in its emotional openness. And once again, Minnelli proves his great talent as a visual stylist, no better than in the scene when MacLaine confronts Hyer in the classroom.
I knew I shouldn't have come, but... Oh, I'm very crazy about him, you see, Miss French. And this is the God's truth. I want him to have what he wants. Even if it means you instead of me.
Well, I assume Mr. Hirsch discussed me with you, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Oh, no, that's not so. Oh, he never said nothing. I kept asking him, but he never said nothing. Here and in Terre Haute and Indianapolis, but he never said nothing.
You were on that trip?
Yeah. Oh, but he ain't in love with me, Miss French. I wish he was. I'd give my right eye if he was.
The widescreen at first conveys the vast gulf between the two characters, only to then break and offer a close and sympathetic gaze to MacLaine in her tears, while keeping Hyer's relatively cold and rigid character at a clear distance. It's magnificent stuff. But, speaking of classrooms, I'm also ready to have Professor Phillips school me on everything I've missed in this film. In the meantime, Adam, thanks to you and to Josh for another really terrific and really rewarding marathon experience. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm looking forward to your thoughts this week and for the awards next week. See ya.
Great stuff once again from Nathaniel. I'm putting him on notice right now, Michael, that when we do get to our Minnelli Marathon Awards, which we're planning to call them the Garlands, why not?
Excellent.
Right?
Excellent.
I think Nathaniel's idea to call them the Garlands, what would this marathon be without him? I'm putting him on notice right now. He's going to have to come on. He's going to have to share his picks. He's
Absolutely.
Not done. His work is not over.
It's just starting.
Yeah,
you've
just
done
starting.
The heavy lifting. You've already laid out the syllabus for
That's
a
it.
6-week course on Minnelli.
There you go.
He's just going to yank it out right out from under you.
Can't happen. But any general responses, thoughts to Nathaniel's take and thoughts on the film? And tell us what you do love about Some
Came
Running.
Where do you begin? I mean, you know, he's really astute on what's strong about Minnelli, especially visually, I think. And no one shot... And that includes all the masters working in Hollywood at the time. No one shot better widescreen CinemaScope compositions than Minnelli, period, I think. Now, it doesn't mean that every film he shot in that format, not that many, worked or mm-hmm. were successful. You look at Brigadoon or Kismet. Well, rather, you should not look at Brigadoon or Kismet. And this is – Some Came Running is the best, though. It's the best widescreen melodrama he ever shot. And – it's based on a truly terrible book by James Jones, and this is James
that
Jones.
That doesn't surprise me.
It's 1,200 pages long, and it's a book about a writer, a self-loathing, pretty unsympathetic writer, as Nathaniel mentioned, mm-hmm. played in the movie by Sinatra. The writer is struggling with his sophomore slump, and he cannot get the second novel out. And it's a novel written and a living evidence of a sophomore slump about a writer dealing with sophomore slump, right? James Jones, a huge success with From Here to Eternity, which turned into a major motion picture, 1953, Fred Zinnemann won Best Picture at the Oscars. And, you know, the book was a huge success, and there was a great deal of anticipation for James Jones's follow-up. and then critically derided. Nobody read it. It's full of risible stereotypes and sort of sexual perversities as far as Jones could take them, in that this is one of these, let's rip the lid off the hypocrisies of small town life and show what a bunch of peeping Toms and repressed virgins like Gwen, the school teacher, and all these
just
people.
Just frauds.
Frauds and sexually fraught and thwarted, or else they're tramps and, you know, quote, pigs, unquote, which is exactly what Sinatra calls
Dean Martin calls him. Yeah.
And Sinatra and Dean Martin, who plays Bama Dillard, the gambler who pals around with the Sinatra character, calls the Shirley MacLaine character. It is not, and Nathaniel's right, it is not easy to stomach some of this because, you know, was it accepted more readily back then? Just, oh, well, he's calling so-and-so a pig. Yes, of course. And I can't really hold Some Came Running up to anything like the light we look at in 2018. It's the whole movie flunks the Me Too movement, okay?
Sure. But and, yeah, we can talk about that later.
Yeah,
sure.
But what I think you have here is one of the great, for me, one of the great adaptations of a truly lousy book. And that's kind of a long list in Hollywood. A lot of very good movies, and certainly I think this is that. And certainly I think Some Came Running is a very good movie. You come from really kind of awful second-rate mechanical material, and they found a way in the adaptation to streamline it, strip it for parts, and get this, you know, and telescope the action from, it used to be 3 years in the novel, and it's down just to a few weeks, where Dave Hirsch, the struggling writer, comes back home to Parkman, Indiana. It was Parkman, Illinois in the novel, to just kind of like reconnect uneasily with his brother, who's a very kind of like, you know, appearance conscious jewelry store owner, played by Arthur Kennedy, who was Oscar nominated, in fact. And then he's got these two women in his life, and that's simply the novel. That's
right.
It. It's what I love about it visually is that Minnelli is shooting on location. They shot 3 weeks in Madison, Indiana. Sinatra was going crazy every day, just sort of bored. Wanted to go up to Chicago to gamble and run around and all that. But there he was, kind of locked in while Minnelli was painstakingly working out his compositions for the, you know, for the town fair climax, and he wanted to move. Do you know the story?
No.
Where Minnelli wanted to be, they spent all day kind of setting up this shot, this nighttime shot with a ton of extras, and it's the big action climax where one of the characters gets killed, and Minnelli said, you know, I got to move that Ferris wheel 6 feet. And Sinatra said, I'm going to Chicago, and I'm not going to finish this picture.
Really?
And he took off. And then, you know, Minnelli was like, you know. And he got him back, and they actually finished the picture ahead of schedule, but it was very frosty. And yet, I think Minnelli got a truly good performance in a truly unsympathetic role out of Sinatra. And I think the interplay between Sinatra and Dean Martin, you know, they certainly never got anything nearly as good in all the films they made later. I think Minnelli shooting on location and yet lighting a lot of the shots, especially the nighttime ones, as if he were in the Hollywood studio. So you have this patently artificial expressionistic, crazy sort of artifice going on in real locations, gives the movie a very, very unique tension, I think. And it's garish, cheap melodrama, and I'm pretty much in the bag for it the whole way.
I wish I was.
What else can I say?
I wish I was with you, Michael.
I know.
No, I. You know, once again, I'm with Nathaniel in a lot of his thoughts, but one of them being just sort of maybe a general dissatisfaction with the movie. And I'll get to the fact that I still think it's absolutely worth seeing and worth discussing.
Right.
It better be, because we're going to talk about it for 15 or 20 more minutes, probably.
We got it. I'm ready.
But you kind of alluded to this in terms of setting up the basic story here. I was about maybe an hour into the film, had to pause it for a second, and while I paused it, I sent Sam a note that just said, what is Some Came Running? Because at that point, I really didn't know what it was as a movie or what it was leading to. I hadn't read any plot synopsis, didn't have any sense of what the film was about, honestly, at all. I knew it had Sinatra in it and Shirley MacLaine. And he gets to Parkman, if you trust the way the movie sets it up, not by his own choice. He just ends up on a bus. He's put there by his army buddies or whatever. Back in Chicago, and he's sent back home. So he has no objective. I'm watching that Sinatra character, Dave, the whole time thinking, well, he must have some angle he's trying to play. He really doesn't.
Nope.
He just kind of rolls with the punches.
He drifts in, and a lot
happens to him. So there's really no objective for the main character. And so maybe the movie felt a little aimless to me, though a lot does happen.
So you're like Arthur Miller. You need a clear objective for your protagonist.
I think I do, unfortunately, or a little bit more of one. That's exactly right. So I don't really love the way most of it's staged. We'll get to some of the best stuff, though. You touched on the truly great carousel, that Ferris wheel, and that expressionistic sequence at the end. I think really is a wonder. And I'll acknowledge that even though I'm sitting here saying I struggled with this movie, there are people I follow on Letterboxd who I greatly respect, who adore this film. Mm-hmm. Labuza, Michael Casey both gave it 4 stars. Max O'Connell, who's been on the show, 4.5 stars. Sean Gilman, Jake Cole, Keith Phipps from The Next Picture Show, 5 stars. So there is a lot of appreciation out there for this film. I'm not in that company. And yet, as I said, totally worth seeing and discussing because it does, at least to me, Michael, feel personal. It feels like Minnelli. He's not just cranking out some piece of material here. This is something that he has internalized and then he has tried to externalize and bring it to the screen. Yeah. And so it's fascinating at times. It's frustrating at times. But I do think this is a great film to conclude this marathon with because it seems to me, just based on what we've seen, based on what we've learned about Minnelli that you've helped guide us through, it's really about this central Minnelli dilemma, which is reconciling one's personal and professional lives. And drilling down into that even more, because that's pretty general, mm-hmm. reconciling one's own reprehensible behavior and actions with their intentions, or maybe the person they think they are or think they want to be, and even one's doubts in their own talents. This question about sort of what you can get away with because you're a so-called talented artist.
You're the tortured artist,
yeah. this man who has those appetites we heard about in that scene between Dave and Gwen. But then underneath that all is this question that maybe Minnelli's asking, which is, okay, that's great if you live a life where you purport yourself to be the tortured artist,
right,
who then tries to get away with things that maybe he shouldn't. But what if you, at your core, don't feel like you're really that talented? What if you feel like you're a phony? What if you feel like you're a fraud, like Dave clearly does in this movie?
As Jim Jones did.
Maybe rightly so,
because the novel was no good.
But there is that key line in the movie, I think, where it seems like a throwaway line, but actually really resonated with me. It's when the Sinatra character says, a little talent to a writer. And he's talking to Gwen here, who is a creative writing teacher,
right,
and really appreciates his work. And she says something to him about, no, you've got some talent. And he says, a little talent to a writer means about as much as a little talent to a brain surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a great line,
yeah,
because you're right. You don't want the brain surgeon who you know, maybe has a little bit of a knack for
right,
it. No,
right.
He's got to be an expert. He's got to be the one who knows, he or she, exactly what they're doing. And in the case of a writer, if you are that writer, I'm guessing most of them feel the same way. Any kind of artist feels like, what's the point if you're just that little bit talented
right,
one? And otherwise, you feel like you're wasting your life. You're wasting kind of the essence of who you are, which is at the core, I think, of Dave's struggle.
Yeah, and I think Minnelli, I think, thought through some of that. And I think in other ways, he kind of disregarded the mechanics of the plot, because even though it is a melodrama, it is not a plot-driven piece. I mean, it takes its time. It wanders around. It really does just sort of, as you say, kind of like sort of wander around this town, mm-hmm, with Dave Hirsch, the Sinatra character. And I think it's useful to talk a little bit about Some Came Running and Minnelli's melodramas in relation to Douglas Sirk's melodramas made around the same time, mostly earlier, because I think they're both skeptical of the stories they're telling and the attitudes being expressed, especially by the conventional male leads. I think they're much more sympathetic to the female characters, even though in Some Came Running, they're both treated very, very archly. And is it a weakness? Yes, probably. Is it a stamp of its time and place and era and the mores and attitudes of Hollywood at the time? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's how I look at Some Came Running. I think Minnelli is not sending it up in any way, but I
right,
think he's really skeptical about the story he has to tell. And I think he's finding what he wants to find and what he's interested in,
yeah,
in the corners and mm-hmm, sort of the dark shadows of this thing, and just letting the actors kind of take it. So, you know, I can't claim that it's a great film. I can only claim that I think there's a weird kind of ambition and grace in a lot of it. And
yeah,
I also just think that when you look at a scene like the long take, which runs 2.5 minutes without a cut, of Sinatra and McLean getting off the Greyhound.
That's another
pulling into town.
Great touch.
I mean, that's a great scene. That is a 2 minute short film that is perfect. And they're talking about the drunken revels the night before up in Chicago, and she's referring to, you know, him as, well, you know, I'm your girl now. So, and he's like, oh my God, what's happened?
Baby, it's a little early for...
Well, I like that. You ask a person to come on a trip with you and
hold
then
it, hold it, hold it. I asked you.
Well, if you didn't, you don't think I would have come, do you? What am I, a tramp or something? Gilly's Green Room, Chicago. I was with Raymond.
Raymond? Raymond?
The fellow you took a poke at.
Oh, yeah.
I remember.
I'd like to forget it.
Gee, Dave, you know, you sure was sweet to me.
Look, sweetie.
You know something? I would kind of like to have a soft bed. What do you say that, what do you say? We go rest up and after that, then we go meet your family. You know, that's just about the highest compliment that a fella can pay his girl, asking him to meet his folks.
Look, sweetie. I feel badly about this, but this is no time for a girl like you.
You know, it's all, it's, yes, the setup's a little hackneyed, but, you know, he's saying things like, this is no town for a girl like you. But I don't know, the way Sinatra and McLean play that, and the way Minnelli just sort of lets it sit and lets the camera kind of take it without any cuts, I don't know. I just think there's some kind of crystallization of what Sinatra's image was at the time when he has to say lines like, oh, you know, a guy gets loaded and meets a girl and look where we are.
Right.
But it's done with a kind of a casual, truthful, tossed off air. And I think that scene alone is why Some Came Running is worth taking seriously.
Yeah, we touched on this a little bit, that the whole movie really is about, I think, hypocrisy. And maybe it gets back to what I was saying about Minnelli and what he might be personally wrestling with here. But there are so many people in this film who are representing themselves as something other than who they really are. That is certainly his brother, Frank, who is a liar and just a phony in really every way. The only characters who seem true to themselves are these ones who are on the fringes, the ones who actually he associates himself with and becomes friendly with. Bama is Bama. It doesn't matter, really, even when he faces a health scare. Right. No, he's going to be exactly who he is all the time. I think Ginny, that's the case with her, too. We'll talk more about her. Gwen, I think, is someone who is a hypocrite, just like so many other people, more established people, the elite in the town. And then you've got our hero, Dave, who doesn't really know, I think, who he is. He has some sense of what he doesn't want to be, and that's like his brother, like his family. But ultimately, he's in conflict. There is a conflict there, which I think makes him kind of our conduit. He's the middle ground between these two sides, people who have some integrity, even if they're the ones who are being excluded from everything and the ones who run everything but are ultimately the fakes. And there is a scene that really gets to that. Actually, it's the one Nathaniel talked about. He talked about the framing, that great scene where Shirley MacLaine's character goes and talks to Gwen, surprises her at the school. It really ends up being a key scene in the movie. And right before Ginny MacLaine walks in, we see and hear the teacher having this conversation with her students, a very pointed conversation appropriate for this movie with her students about the role of an artist and these men, these hard drinking men, these promiscuous men. And she basically,
it's so on point.
It's so on point. The teacher is able to be objective and detached and say, well, it's all worth it. It's worth it to have their work. I may not agree with who they are, but basically I can tolerate it because we got their work and it's understandable. She totally writes off that behavior. And so my first reaction was, you know, great job, Minnelli. Thanks for giving us a scene that basically excuses any tortured artist behavior, including potentially your own. But that scene really does ultimately show Gwen's own hypocrisy. As a teacher, she can detach herself. As a person, she's got that tortured artist in her life, and she really doesn't give him that slack at all. She doesn't give him that benefit of the doubt at all. So
no, and look,
it's an interesting argument, though, this idea that we can claim to understand the artist, but when it actually gets messy and we're the ones involved, it affects us personally. We don't feel the same way at all. And so he is exposing that, I think, a little bit in this one character. I think it's also appropriate to close this marathon with this movie because we started with a quote-unquote problematic one, Cabin in the Sky, and here we are, I think, ending with one. You've touched on this. Cabin, as we discussed, undeniably a genuine appreciation and celebration of Black culture, also undeniably pretty racist, right? This is a movie that Some Came Running is, I think you could argue, an indictment. I think some might be able to argue, I'm not sure if I'm totally the person cut out for it, is actually an indictment of toxic masculinity, a phrase, of course, that Minnelli and anyone else involved in this film at the time never would have used.
Right, right.
But it is also not just depicting, but seeming to endorse the idea that these difficult men should be able to get away with almost anything they want to, especially if they're tortured artists.
Right.
And really, we should just let them work through all their problems, no matter how much harm they cause. I think that the end of the film, and I'll dance around it here just a little bit in case people are listening to this and haven't seen the film and want to check it out, but the end of the movie, I think, is ground zero for how some people will respond to this film and that specific point in terms of the misogyny of the film. You have a woman at the end of this movie who truly is the one who ends up suffering. And she's not only the only non-hypocrite in the film, the only person of integrity really in this whole movie, a person who cares so much about other people, people beyond herself, that she goes and has that conversation with her rival, her so-called rival. She still cares so much about her own feelings. There's no malice in that at all. There's nothing at all about that that is her trying to get at her in any way. And yet, at the end of this movie, she's the one that's punished for her sins,
right.
I think. And I think that you could look at that two ways. You could say, okay, Minnelli, boy, he gets it. That is the way the world most often works, that the innocent, the woman in this case, is the one who's going to be the one who suffers. But there's something about this movie, too, Michael, that just tells me it's so easy to punish her. And it only ultimately serves him. It makes her suffering at the end of this film actually makes him look better. He had such fondness and respect for her finally that he was able to appreciate this needy and naive woman. It finally brought
him
around.
Yeah, but it's a horrible match. I mean, it's like,
it is.
You know,
it really is.
No, Sinatra's.
We're all rooting for them not to be together.
Right. It's not. I think. I would argue that Minnelli is not exactly investing a lot of optimism in that, especially because
right.
the way the story is about to take it. But look, like a lot of 50s melodrama, and melodrama before it, and since this is. It's a feminist nightmare. There's no question about it. It's hung up completely on this Madonna whore complex, and it's never made any clearer than in that classroom scene where you have the whore visiting the Madonna,
yes.
the sexually repressed, you know, like lively intellectual but completely frigid. And, you know, these are the novel. If you ever really want to read 1,200 pages of, like, how the hell would they ever adapt this to a film, read James Jones's
no
novel. Of the, and, I mean, you have – there's so much talk about everything from Hinduism to the Kinsey Report to the fact that Dave's brother, Frank, played by Arthur Kennedy, in the novel is you know, having the affair with his secretary. He's shut out at home by this – you know, this kind of like seething wife. And he becomes, for many, many pages in the novel, Upkeeping Tom. He
really?
Goes to other towns. So it's like every...
So he doesn't just transgress. I
no,
mean, he becomes
the perversion,
a full-blown violator.
Exactly. The perversions in the novel are really, quote, hysterical in sort of every way. But I think... And the movie, you know, acknowledges that. But it sort of asks you and almost dares you to read a little bit between the lines about what they could get away with
yeah.
on screen then and in the screenplay and what they couldn't. And... That's a lot of it. I mean, Minnelli was coming off melodramas he made just earlier in the 50s, like The Cobweb, Tea and Sympathy, which is based on a famous play, where they had to tone down the homosexual aspects of the story and just sort of play it down the middle, much as Tennessee Williams ran into the same problem in 58, same year as Some Came Running, when they adapted Cat on a Hot Tin Roof for the screen, where they had to dance around this question about Brick, Paul Newman's character.
Yes.
And, you know, is he, you know, what happened with Skipper back when? Well, nothing to do with homosexuality. Nothing. I swear to God, nothing.
Uh-huh.
And this is the atmosphere. You know, you go back to King's Row in the 40s. You go back to Peyton Place, a huge scandalous success in 1957. You know, all these stories of... tearing the lid off the hypocrisies and perversions of small town life. You know, that's it. But you know, there's something potent and irresistible about it when you have a director who can really give it the sauce, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you get a scene like the scene in the writer's cabin where Sinatra is with Gwen and she's finally relenting and his, you know,
mm-hmm.
the Sinatra charms are working. And then she's torn.
That's one way to put it.
She's torn, you know, she doesn't know. And then... It's a brightly lit daytime
scene. It's all about
the
lighting, yeah.
And then suddenly she takes one step
yes.
forward and she's cast in like this kind of cavernous shadow and it's a striking moment.
It is.
And Minnelli's like, wake up, watch it. Now we're inside her head, you know. And you can buy it. You don't have to believe it. Whatever. It is just visually staggering, I think. And that,
yeah.
And then you're out of it again. And it's almost like you dreamed it, you know. So that's Minnelli at his best.
And those are the three moments. We've now hit on all three that really stood out to me.
We're done.
Because those are the wondrous moments in this film. The opening, for the most part, opening widescreen shot, watching Frank Sinatra and Shirley MacLaine basically
get to know each other outside the bus for two and a half minutes.
That's wonderful. That end climax, watching Ray, I think his name is, who kind of appears. He's someone who has a thing for Shirley MacLaine's character.
He's the underworld thug from Chicago.
Right. He reappears at the end of the movie, and there are many shots, but that one of him in particular coming out of the dark, walking kind of hurriedly, running right towards the camera with those lights of the Ferris wheel going behind him, that is so striking. And then that's the other one that I would most like to go back and really just break down if you were going to do a scene study. And it makes me think, actually, of Meet Me in St. Louis a little bit, where my favorite scene in that movie is the one on the staircase where Judy Garland adjusts the lighting.
Great scene.
Right? It sets up the whole mood of everything and really makes him fall in love with her in that moment by adjusting those lights.
It's a lovely
Here it's Minnelli, the one who's obviously doing the adjusting of the lighting, and it's not a scene of a prelude to love, but a prelude to love making.
Right.
But it suggests so many things. It suggests that it could be this kind of wonderful thing. It also suggests almost something sinister.
Yeah.
There's something a little menacing because of the lighting choices too. So I did really appreciate what he does there. You're right, something really unnatural in an otherwise natural film.
Right. And Scorsese, among others, has talked and written a lot about that climax of Some Came Running. And because it is completely leaving plain old everyday Indiana realism in the dust.
It just goes by. Yeah, it goes away.
You know, and it's much closer to like a Powell and Pressburger moment where you're getting these feverish sort of intense saturated colors. And it's just a different palette, different world altogether.
Yeah.
And Minnelli did live for that kind of thing. Now this, I don't know, I'd probably argue with you about whether or not this is a particularly personal film for him. I think for him it's more like, okay, this is my next MGM assignment. I'm adapting a problematic novel by a guy who had a hit the first time, and I've got my star, Sinatra. Now, how do I fill this out? How do I cast it around Sinatra and try to get something a little less ridiculous out of this novel? And I think almost every decision he made based on those initial parameters, perfect.
Okay. Yep. Well, I guess I'm approaching this with a very auteurist point of view, but whether consciously or not, I feel like his personality is coming through.
Well,
and I'm not basing that on anything I know about him. I know very little about him as a real person. I'm speaking just from watching his films. But there is this dichotomy that is at play in this film, that's at play in a lot of these films, where you do have this kind of all-knowing cynicism that just permeates this entire film, and then it's mixed in with this wide-eyed innocence and this sense of compassion that whether that's what Minnelli really wants to strive for or that's the material, I don't know. But there is this strong urge to reinforce this notion of love winning out and this idea of unconditional love, which is really at the core of this film. That key line, I think, the one where Dave has that epiphany, is when MacLaine says, "I don't understand you neither, but that doesn't mean I don't like you."
Yeah.
So, unlike every other person in the film that wants to change him into their image of what he should be, she's the only one who accepts him for exactly who he is. And he responds to that. And I think really the key line that I don't know, I wanted to maybe go so far as to say it seems like the line that in some ways sums up this marathon, at least in terms of a piece of dialogue. If you go against the visuals and just a line of dialogue, when MacLaine says at the end of that scene where they have decided that they're going to be together, that they've had that moment of understanding, she says, "You got to remember, I'm human."
"I'm sorry if I hurt you. Forgive me. I didn't mean it. I'm terribly sorry."
"You know I'd do anything for you, Dave. I'd do anything you ask me."
Would you clean up the place for me?"
"Oh, could I?"
"Sure."
"Oh, sure. Oh, I'd love to. Oh, I sure, I'd love to. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll come every day before work. you just call me. You gotta remember, I'm human.
I just feel like it's this struggle that we've seen in so many of these films, and The Bad and the Beautiful is another one, where characters are naturally, instinctively who they are, and that can sometimes come with a cost, right. And there are consequences to that, and they hurt a lot of people along the way.
Right, and they're always and they're all right, tormented.
There's
artists.
this yeah. pull in them. There is that little consciousness gnawing at them, and these other characters who are openly basically pleading with them to say, just remember, I'm a human being. I have a soul. I have a heart. You're
right.
Really, you're destroying me.
Yes.
And sometimes the characters seem oblivious to that.
Yeah, yeah. And look, you can even get glimpses of that in Phantom Thread, where it was the
another movie that's hot in the toxic masculinity
exactly,
discussion.
Exactly.
Days.
And,
yes.
And you know, it's certainly more woke. You know,
yes.
In terms of Paul Thomas Anderson, the writer-director, not letting the Daniel Day-Lewis character off the hook. I think he knows damn well he's toxic. And
yes.
The Vicky Krebs character, Alma, deals with that toxicity her own way and with modest amounts of poison. And, you know, that's a whole different – that takes a story
watching,
in a very different
– Yeah, and watching Some Came Running, I think a lot of us wish that – McClane's character was written a little bit more like
absolutely.
The character in Phantom
yeah.
Thread, but that's simply not that's not the material.
Yeah, it's like me looking at Cabin in the Sky at the
yeah.
beginning of Minnelli's career and thinking, you know, I wish the fact that it was actually the least offensive and egregious African-American stereotyping in an all-black musical or all-black film of any kind coming out of Hollywood at the time, which were few and far between. You know, you can take it back to Shakespeare where, you know, is there anti-Semitic attitudes in Merchant of Venice? Yes. Does he also give Shylock the speech that says, hath
yeah.
not a Jew eyes? Yes. So you have to take,
right.
if you're going to deal with them at all, you have to take the worst of it with the best of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, after the Merchant of Venice reference, I'll take this down a notch in terms of highbrow, lowbrow. The night before I watched this film, I took my daughter to see Grease on the big screen because it was an American movie classic.
Madonna
sort of.
Horror, baby.
Yeah, there you go. It's
you know?
It's the same thing again.
It
right?
is.
So 40th anniversary, they're showing it on some screens. The
right.
theater near us is playing it. My daughter, Sophie, has seen it twice before, but we wanted to go see it on
Do
the big screen.
Do you want your daughter to turn into a tramp?
Yeah, I guess so,
yeah,
apparently.
Okay, there you go. All right.
And I really have no point, Michael, other than sometimes the way these things line up is funny to me,
know,
right?
It's funny.
Where it's like you go see Grease, which is a movie all about these characters struggling with being in love with each other and how it goes against maybe who they think they are
right,
or this
right,
image
right,
of
right,
themselves.
Right.
And you've got, you know, John Travolta at the end walking around with the Rydell Letterman's jacket
right,
on.
Right,
and,
right.
of course, Olivia Newton-John, Sandy, has decided to put on the black leather. And here you've got a movie where the same thing happens in the sense that you've got Dave being so into the goody-two-shoes Gwen
yes.
that he starts wearing the nice suit every day and he's not drinking anymore and he tries to be a different person.
A respectable
intellectual.
Yeah.
And ultimately, he can't be that person. So I just thought it was interesting that I felt like I just watched this
movie.
Well,
look, and, you know, look, Grease was written as this sort of slapdash, you know, sardonic kind of goof on that idea. But we are still living with these
yes.
these infernal female archetypes, especially the
mm-hmm.
female. And they're just as troubling and just as prevalent today. Maybe less so in the last year just because of so many shifts in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you can look at – you have to look at Some Came Running from a perspective of, you know, 60 years later now of just kind of thinking – you know, was that really what the attitudes were? Was it, and are we questioning, you know,
mm-hmm.
what Dave is even really thinking and saying? Hard, you know, maybe not. But at the same time, I do think Minnelli visually is always giving you a reason to kind of not fully believe in what that guy's about.
And maybe
you know,
that's part of my struggle with it.
Yeah.
Honestly, I mean, I respect that choice. And yet it seems at odds with the movie and the material.
You know what I would say seriously
yeah.
to everybody who even is half interested in the film we're talking about? Take time to see the next one he made because I think if you see Home from the Hill, which stars Robert Mitchum, George Peppard, George Hamilton, and it's a Texas family melodrama about this sort of like fearsome patriarch and these two sons, one illegitimate, one legitimate, quote unquote. And that is actually much closer to films that kind of take us into the 60s further, like HUD and certainly into like Texas melodramas, you know, on television later, like Dallas and all that. But it's a very restrained and very dark and unsentimental film. And It probably would play better with the 2018 audience than something that's more strikingly of its time and sort of the middle of the 50s, which is Some Came Running.
Appropriately from Professor Phillips here, some homework for all of us.
And Home from the Hill, baby.
I do want to see Home for the Hill. Now, one last little reference, again, lining up with recent conversations or recent viewings. I only did a cursory Google search, so I don't know if there's more out there on this topic or if they've ever gone on the record about this. I didn't see anything, but how could the Coen brothers not be influenced by this film? Specifically, we recently had our Sacred Cow discussion of Miller's Crossing on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Gabriel Byrne's character, his obsession with me hat.
The
He's
hat.
Always got to have his
Absolutely.
Hat, just like Dean Martin's Bama character here, who, just like Byrne, is constantly saying, where's my hat? Even after he's gotten into a brawl and the hat's come up, where's my hat is the first thing he's got to know. There's just really no way that's a coincidence.
Godard was ripping it off in Contempt. I mean, it's that hat.
Yeah.
And that film was very big with the cinema crowd. And it was. And does it have that kind of influence or effect in the popular culture now? No, not at all. You look at Some Came Running like this exotic artifact from another planet, and that's kind of what it is.
Some Came Running is available to rent or stream on most platforms. If you see it and agree or disagree with what we had to say, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, Josh and I will finish off the marathon with the Garlands Are Best of the Minnelli Marathon Awards. Michael, we're going to have to get at least your best scene, I think, on the record. Your favorite Minnelli. I think I know it, actually. You've already said it.
Well,
you said it. It's the bandwagon, right?
I can name you a million like that.
Okay.
We don't have enough
time for that.
No, I have time.
You'll have to pick one.
No, I have time. This is a podcast. It goes on forever.
You're right. There's no
it's
space.
Like, it's like Cup Show in the old days. You know, they can just go on until 4 a.m.
There you go. Later this week on the podcast, Michael and I will have a review of A Quiet Place. We will use hushed tones the entire time. It will be really suspenseful, along with our top 5 quiet scenes, and we will announce the 2018 Film Spotting Madness Best of the 90s champion, Pulp Fiction or Fargo. Speaking of suspense, I know it's killing Michael. I see it in your face.
It is.
You can't wait to find out.
Can I just throw in one last line?
Yeah.
I want you, every time we tape, no matter what we're talking about, I want you to remember this line from Some Came Running. Adam, I'm not one of your barroom tarts. Okay.
I will keep that in mind. Keep it close to the heart. Our thanks, as always, to Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Andy Mitchell. For Film Spotting, for Michael Phillips, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.